You are listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. From new CDC mask guidelines to the efficacy of a COVID vaccine, there is a lot to talk about today with our medical experts. And if you have a question for them, it is time to send us an email. You can do that at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Joining us today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, as well as Dr. Ryan Williams, the medical director for Direct COVID Care. This is a monoclonal antibody clinic in Boise. He is also a hospitalist at St. Alphonsus in Boise. I want to thank both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Pate, let's just start with an update on where we are here in Idaho when it comes to COVID, in particular the Omicron variant, because we are seeing those numbers drop all across the country. They're dropping here, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're out of the woods at this point.
Well, that's a good way to describe everything, Gemma. Just as you said, cases across the country are coming down. Cases in Idaho are coming down. It's clear that we're on the other side of this Omicron surge. And now we can't get complacent because still we have some fairly high transmission levels. We were a bit late to the game with Omicron here in Idaho relative to a lot of states. So they have recovered to lower levels than we have. We still have a lot of areas around the state that have high transmission. So, but it is getting better and it should continue to do so as we wait to see if we're going to get a good long reprieve or if we're going to be faced with a new variant in the upcoming weeks or months.
Dr. Williams, you run a monoclonal antibody clinic in Boise. Can you talk about the latest antibody treatments? Because we do know that the monoclonal antibodies worked very well with the Delta variant. They weren't working as well with Omicron. So where are we in terms of all of that?
Yeah, great question, Gemma. So thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm the medical director for Direct COVID Care, and hopefully some of you have heard about this. It's a clinic that we got up and running from a grant from the state of Idaho and the Department of Health and Welfare. And we initially started using the monoclonal antibody called RegenCov, or Regeneron was another name for it. And that was very effective against the Delta strain, which was the dominant strain in our area. I can't remember exactly when it started, but early November or even before that. So October through December and most of January, or at least mid-January, the Delta strain was the dominant strain. And the RegenCov was very effective against the Delta strain. And when I say effective, I mean it decreased hospitalizations by roughly 75%. So decreased risk of death and hospitalizations if you had diagnosed COVID. About mid-January, we started to see the Omicron virus variant be a lot more prevalent in Idaho, and it quickly overcame the Delta strain. Towards the end of January, it was like 99% or 98% of the cases were Omicron. Unfortunately, the RegenCov antibody, monoclonal antibody, was not effective against the Omicron strain, but other monoclonal antibodies were, including one called sotrovimab. And this is the one we've been giving out over the last month and a few weeks. It's IV only. The infusion takes roughly 15 to 30 minutes to infuse, and then there's an hour long waiting period. And this has been very effective against the Omicron virus. So it decreases hospitalization and risk of death by roughly 80%. So we saw a great number of patients. We roughly treated over 800 patients overall. out of those 800 patients, only three patients were admitted to the hospital. So it was a great success for our community to have this clinic available.
And I want to talk about these new CDC mask guidelines that came out, I believe, over the weekend, late last week. Dr. Payne, can we go through what this means? Because the CDC is now saying, based on where you live, based on not just the numbers, but like hospital capacity, you don't necessarily need to wear a mask inside anymore. Over the weekend, I got on the CDC website. I looked at where Ada County is. It's still recommended that we wear masks indoors. But those numbers are changing every day. But it kind of confuses things. So can you talk about these guidelines?
Well, I can. I have some confusion as well. The question is, where did the guidelines come from? The CDC published their last science brief on December 17th, and the last science brief on the community use of masks was on December 6th. So we don't know what science they were looking at when they decided to change the guidance to what they did. It's interesting, though. If you go back to December and you read how the CDC arrived at their decision back then, they say it was to prevent the transmission of SARS-CoV-2. And you know that for the past 2 years, I've been talking about we need to decrease the transmission of SARS-CoV-2, even if it's not killing large numbers of people, even if it's not ending up with large numbers of people in the hospital, because the more transmission we have, the more variants we'll have. And as you just listened to Dr. Williams, who described it very well, what has happened is when we've gotten new variants of concern, it has sometimes meant that our previous therapies wouldn't work or wouldn't work as well as he outlined. Additionally, we find that certain variants that evolve mean that our vaccines don't work as well. So I do think the CDC was on the right track in December. Now, what they're doing now is changing it so that the focus is not on decreasing transmission. The focus seems to be on not overburdening the healthcare system. And that's a worthy goal as well, because it's certainly a bad situation when our healthcare system gets overwhelmed. But what I would say is these guidelines are much more reactive than proactive. And of course, I think that's where a lot of the sentiment in this country is, but we certainly want to see the CDC stick to the science and make sure that they are giving us guidance based on that. I'm not sure they hit a home run with that. I do think it is good to take other factors besides just community transmission into consideration with masking, particularly in schools. But I think we'll see fairly soon whether this guidance turns out to be helpful to us or harmful to us.
And with that said, Dr. Pate, many of Idaho's four-year public universities are going mask optional as well.
Yeah, we're going to have to come to grips with some things. One is we've never really come to grips, even though we've known about it now for almost 2 years, we've never come to grips with aerosol transmission. We talked about a lot about respiratory droplet transmission, but we really haven't talked very much, especially from the CDC, on aerosol transmission. And I think that's caused some of these universities and others to discount the importance of that. Another thing that I think has been left out of the conversation is that too often our conversation, and we've talked about this on your show, Gemma, that too often the conversation is just focused on death rates or hospital rates. And we've had very little national discussion about all the other bad things that can happen to you if you're infected. I think there is a common talking point that getting infected with this virus is going to strengthen your immune system. I would say that more and more of the evidence that we're seeing now calls that seriously into question, and that, in fact, we may be harming ourselves. And frankly, we don't know what the long-term impact is going to be to some of these people that are getting repeatedly infected. And we're starting to see some data that is concerning. So I think that a lot of this is this now mantra about we have to learn to live with the virus, which I think is code for let's just take our chances. I don't think that's a wise strategy. I do think we're going to see a lot of long-term health problems, and we're going to see a lot of increase in long-term healthcare costs. And that's going to be a burden on employers.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Williams, can we talk about nursing facilities? I know that you manage several skilled nursing facilities throughout the Treasure Valley. How are they doing now compared to what we were seeing, not just in the beginning of the pandemic, but frankly, until we started being able to vaccinate folks living in nursing facilities?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. And if I could add to what Dr. Pate has said, I couldn't agree more. You know, it's one thing to measure the hospitalization rate and the death rate, but it's harder to measure the morbidity of long COVID and these mm-hmm. quote long haulers and the chronic fatigue and all the, you know, subsequent side effects and adverse symptoms that a large percentage of patients, post-COVID patients, are experiencing. And when my, you know, in my discussions with patients on whether or not to vaccinate, as you can imagine, we had those conversations almost daily. This is a point of reference that I would give them, is that, yeah, especially the younger patients, their risk of dying is very low. And the risk of having a bad outcome from the vaccine is a lot lower than that, but it's still very, very low. But the risk of long COVID is mm-hmm. in some instances 10 to 40% of having wow. long-term or at least months of symptoms post-COVID. And I don't know if Jim, if you have questions about that later, but I couldn't agree more that this question of how COVID will affect our healthcare system and our job market in the future is a big question mark. And I think there's a lot to be answered.
Well, and I would like to talk more about that later in the show, Dr. Williams, because it is something where I think sometimes we tend to skip over these long-term impacts, even if you recover from COVID. So with that said, though, how are our skilled nursing facilities looking these days?
Yeah, back to the nursing home. So, you know, I've been a medical director for several nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities in the Treasure Valley for about 5 or 6 years. So when we saw the initial infections in Washington, that poor mm-hmm. building in Washington that got hit pretty hard with a roughly 50% mortality rate, it really scared us. There was a palpable like angst in the buildings, both not just with the patients, but the staff. And I mean, I have several nurses that came to me in tears saying, what's going to happen if it comes to our building, and how are our patients going to survive? And as all of you know, it was lockdown. I mean, we locked down way more than, you know, any business or the rest of the states. And it was full PPE and testing and no visitors. And I would tell my patients that, you know, if they ever go to prison, it will be easy because, and they would laugh, but it was so hard. Because we even went remote visits for a while, which if you can imagine our poor, you know, patients that are hard of hearing anyways, can't see that well, trying to do a telehealth visit with a doc on the other end of a phone or an iPad, it was just not optimal care. And so as soon as we could, we got back into the buildings. But once the vaccine came out, I cannot tell you how much hope that gave us. the vast majority of patients in one building, we had 100% patient vaccination rate, 100%.
Wow.
Most of the buildings at this point are 90% or above patient vaccination rate. And it was like a ray of hope. Now our staff, if you can imagine, they're just like the rest of Idaho. So that we had a lot of staff that were reluctant to get vaccinated. But our numbers were better than the state of Idaho. I think most of our buildings have roughly 75 to 80% of our staff vaccinated at this point. But it was a game changer, hands down. And what we've seen subsequently is that, yes, well, initially just about every building had an outbreak of COVID. Most of my buildings did not have a mortality rate of greater than 10%, which is much better than the 40 to 50% in some of these other buildings nationwide. And I attribute that to strict mask wearing, decreased viral load, and just the vigilance of the staff and the patients in preventing COVID. But once the majority of our patients were vaccinated, we still had occasional outbreaks, but our mortality rate was like 1%. It drastically decreased. So even though patients in our skilled nursing facilities, some were or did test positive for COVID, the vast majority of them either had minimal symptoms, no symptoms, or just, you know, the sicker ones recovered at a higher rate than the pre-vaccine COVID outbreaks.
Dr. Pate, KTVB reported yesterday that Idaho health officials are moving away from daily case counts to measure COVID trends. Talk about this. Is this a good idea?
Well, I'm not sure. I have lots of questions of what they actually mean by that. I do know that they, like the rest of us, are trying to take in this new CDC mask guidance that you and I discussed in the last segment, where the CDC has change the mask guidance from simply looking at disease transmission, in which case the daily counts or the 7-day moving average is one of the best indicators of that. And so I don't know if it just means that they want to take a similar approach to align it so there's not a lot of public confusion, or does it mean they really want to move away from reporting daily cases. I hope it's not the latter. And the reason that I think, and I know some other states have or are in the process of moving away from this, I think the reason that's not a good idea at this time is that, as I said, I think the guidance the CDC put out really changes from a proactive to a reactive response. Which may be fine when you're dealing with an entire population of people. The problem is that when you look at that population, within that population, there are people at a particularly high risk. And those include all the people with chronic medical conditions, people that are immunocompromised, people like Dr. Williams was talking about that are in nursing homes, and also our young children who are not yet vaccinated. So while the general public may be able to take a reactive stance, these people at high risk cannot, or if they do, we're going to be in trouble because a lot of them are going to have bad outcomes from that. So I do think we need to continue to provide the daily counts, or at least the 7-day moving average, so that people can make their own assessments where they do have people at high risk in their families. I'm just not sure yet what the state is actually intending.
And with that being said, Dr. Williams, Sue sent us in this question. And she says that she knows a lot of people who get COVID symptoms and they just take a rapid at-home test. If it's negative, they go to work, even if they're sick. If it's positive, they might stay home a day or two. But none of these folks ever report what's going on to state health officials. So Sue's question is, so how in the world can we know how many cases we actually have?
Yeah, that's a great question. As far as I understand, the state is capturing both the rapid antigen tests, if they're done in a clinic or a skilled nursing facility. And then of course they're for sure capturing the PCR tests, but the at-home tests are not being captured. Those patients or those, the public is not reporting those numbers to the state. So how can we accurately capture? We probably can't accurately 100% capture all the positives, but I think it's a spectrum where you'll always have a certain amount of patients, particularly the ones that are sicker, that will seek medical care at a clinic or an urgent care or an ER, and then those positive results will be captured. So I think it's a surrogate value that we can extrapolate in general. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It does. Dr. Payne, I want to talk about a study that came out in the last few days saying that the Pfizer vaccine may offer little protection against infection in kids 5 to 11 year old. It said researchers found that the vaccine's effectiveness dropped to 12% from 68% amid the Omicron surge. But then after this study came out, another one came out saying that it was effective. So can we break this down? I have a 10-year-old. So as a mom, I saw this and it took me aback.
Yeah. Well, I can understand that. what I would say is to all those parents who did get their 5 to 11 year olds vaccinated, even with all this data, you should still be glad you did. And that is because they are getting some protection. What these studies are pointing out is they're not getting as much protection as we would have hoped and that we were used to prior to Omicron. So there are several things going on here that makes this a little bit complicated. Mm-hmm. First of all, people often get confused about what vaccine efficacy is. And you really have to understand that at sometimes they're talking about the efficacy of not getting infected, and other times they're talking about the efficacy of not getting severe disease. The good news is that the vaccines gave children, even in this 5 to 11 year old age group, a lot of protection against getting severely ill. What was shown dramatically decreased was the ability to prevent them from getting infected at all. And I just have to remind people that preventing all infection was never the intention. If you go back to the summer of 2020, that's not how these vaccines were designed or studied. They were studied about preventing people from getting symptomatically ill and ending up severely ill. Now, there's probably a combination of three things going on. Number one is Omicron. And you heard Dr. Williams talk in the first segment about, with the changing variants, some of the monoclonals no longer work or are as effective. The same thing happens with the vaccine. And this is why we have recommended that we not let the virus just rip in our communities and have uncontrolled transmission, because with time, they will develop the ability to evade some of this immune protection from the vaccines and even natural infection. So Omicron did that. Now, the second issue, so one issue is the strain itself. And for people that got vaccinated, you know, we don't know what we're going to be dealing with next. There's a lot of people that think that the next one will probably go back to be some kind of relative of Delta, in which we know that these vaccines work much better. So I think we have to wait and see. Number two, there is good reason to believe that in an abundance of caution, not wanting any children to get harmed from the vaccine, they picked too low of a dose. And the reason I say that is because they did get immune responses. They just didn't get it as strong. And what we saw is in very young, 6 months to 2 years, which was not reported in this group, they actually did get a very, very strong response, much closer to the older children and young adults. So, you know, it is probably dose was a big factor. The third issue is the interval. I think a lot of vaccinologists believe the interval between the two shots is just too short. We probably need to spread that out a little bit. And just giving vaccines at 21 days, when you understand how the immune system works, it's not ideal. We started that because we were dealing with quite a crisis back in the beginning of 2021, when we had a lot of seniors and people with high risk dying. And so we rushed it, and we knowingly did. We probably now need to be looking at spreading that interval out a little bit.
So with that said, Dr. Pate, we know that I believe kids 12 and over can get a booster shot. With the information we have now with 5 to 11-year-olds, should we be seeing, I mean, granted this comes from the FDA and the CDC, but boosting those 5 to 11-year-olds?
Yeah, and that's what they're looking at right now. I think that the companies will probably look at two different scenarios. One is, do these kids just need a third shot? And that's very likely. And that is also very likely to address this shortfall. The other is, they may begin doing trials again with this age group, but with a higher dose. But I think the focus right now will be looking at, will these children benefit from a third shot? And that is ongoing right now. In fact, we expect to have the answer to that question probably within a month.
I want to talk about long COVID. Dr. Williams, we talked about this a little bit in the top of the program, but we have two questions that have come in since then. Edith from Star and Julia both wrote in. Edith is asking for you to talk about the long-term effects of COVID, like strokes, neurological problems, cardiac problems, et cetera. Julia says that she has a family member that has long COVID, and it has basically ruined their physical and mental health. And she wants to know, what progress have we made in helping people with long COVID?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question right there. Yeah. And I think there's still, there's ongoing, you know, studies to figure out, you know, why. Let me go back. So long COVID is, I guess the definition is persistent symptoms after your acute COVID for more than 4 weeks after your acute COVID infection. But what we're seeing is patients are having long COVID symptoms after 3 months, and even obviously longer than that. And there is no correlation between severity of illness and long COVID risk. And what I mean by that is you could have been in the ICU, super sick on a ventilator, recovered, and your chance of having long COVID is the same as those that just had relatively mild symptoms of fatigue, sore throat, you know, cough, some shortness of breath, maybe the mm-hmm. GI symptoms. And we don't really know why, unless Dr. Pate knows why. I'm not sure if we know that information. The study I recently read was from the British Journal of Medicine. It was a pretty comprehensive study about long COVID. And there's several different classes. I think the fatigue is probably the most prevalent. It's just debilitating fatigue. And this is not just, oh, I'm a little tired. This is, mm-hmm. I'm exhausted. I don't want to get out of bed. I have no energy, and bordering on, you know, pathological or you know, the clinical fatigue. Some studies show up to 60% of patients that have had COVID have long-term fatigue. And then you have the, you know, so each organ system has its own manifestation of long COVID symptoms. So you have the respiratory symptoms of shortness of breath, breathlessness, dyspnea. You have the cardiovascular system that patients have heart attacks, chest pain, myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle, which we saw quite a bit in our younger patients. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the dreaded kind of COVID brain or the fog brain or mental fog. And that's some of the cognitive deficits that we've seen, which can range from depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD. And then, of course, some of the milder symptoms like loss of taste or smell. And this is one of the, I think I mentioned it before, is the reasons I kind of stress people getting the vaccine and not chancing just getting the novel COVID virus. And letting their immune system take care of it, right? Because of the risk mm-hmm. of long COVID. I have a friend that just a couple of weeks ago, he had COVID about a year ago and said, Ryan, I still can't taste Mexican food. And I love Mexican food. Wow. So, yeah. You know, it's a mild symptom, but to him, that's a big deal. So even the most minimal symptoms, which we'd say, oh, well, what's the big deal of not being able to smell? It's a huge deal. So that's kind of a rundown of what can happen. The treatment course is really patient specific. So there are some evidence that if you go the chronic fatigue syndrome route of treating patients, that may really help. But I guess in the short run, I would urge all the patients that have symptoms of long COVID to talk to their primary care docs, because each organ system can benefit from different treatment modalities.
I appreciate you explaining all of that, because I think that that's what can be concerning for folks. Even if you get a mild case, you don't know if you would get long COVID or not, Dr. Williams. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a ton of rhyme or reason to it right now.
Right. Yeah. And there's, you know, there's genetic studies on the opposite end of the spectrum. I just read a study today about patients that never get COVID, that have never gotten COVID, but have been exposed multiple times, have their whole family has gotten it. And so there's different theories of why that is, but, it's on the opposite spectrum of this long COVID, where I don't think we really understand why some are plagued with this and why others aren't. Mm-hmm. But I do recommend, you know, making sure your primary care doctor provider works up non-COVID causes of illness. So don't just assume, well, I had COVID 3 months ago and I'm still super exhausted. It must be long COVID. Make sure you rule out other causes of fatigue and your symptoms. So don't just chalk it up to, oh, it just must be long COVID. Maybe you have a thyroid issue. Maybe you have low blood counts. Maybe you have a DVT or a PE, a blood clot in the lung. So there's, I do recommend, you know, there's definitely no magic pill or vitamin or, you know, magic bullet for long COVID, but to discuss this treatment options and workup frequently with your primary care doc.
Dr. Pate, Donna wrote in, she says, I've been able to schedule an appointment for next week to get a second booster after 5 months have passed since my first booster. Is there any danger in doing so? Also, is there any reason not to get a second booster, even if it's not recommended?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I get it a lot. The bottom line is we don't know the answer to that. I would say several things. Number one, there is a theoretical reason to believe it may not be a good idea to do that. And it's complicated and far too complicated for me to explain in a few minutes on radio, but there is a theoretical reason at least why we would be a little bit hesitant to do that. I think we need to wait for the data, for the studies. Those are being done. The second thing is that, you know, as we talked about the 5 to 11 year olds, but I should indicate and bring to your attention that for adults, we are getting much better results from the booster shots. Yes, there is some waning effect, but actually a study just came out on the Moderna vaccine and showed that booster was extremely effective, more than I thought it would be, although we still haven't followed it out long enough in terms of time. The other thing is, I don't think one should look at that 5 month time interval being the same. This kind of goes back to the point that I was trying to make about the 5 to 11 year olds, where that initial interval may be a little bit too short. The 5 months after the first two shots is very important, because that gives the booster kind of the prime time to react, to boost the system. That is not necessarily or even likely to be the case for the second booster. So I would not equate those two time periods. I have been boosted once. I have no intention to go get boosted a second time until the data shows that we should. I think you should just continue to exercise precautions and hang on, because that study and that evaluation is ongoing. We may very well have another recommendation for a second booster, but unless you are moderately or severely immunocompromised, I would not recommend it at the present time.
Dr. Williams, Peggy wrote in saying in the last 2 weeks, they have two family members who were diagnosed with mild cases of Bell's palsy. Both are fully vaccinated. One had Pfizer, one had Moderna. So her question is there some type of connection between the vaccine and Bell's palsy?
Yes, another great question. I don't think there's been a direct correlation between Bell's palsy and the vaccine. And here's what I can, just from off the top of my head, so I'm not doing a literature search right now, but, what we've seen in the community, at least, is out of thousands and thousands of people being vaccinated, we have not seen an increase in prevalence of any acute neurologic issue like Bell's palsy or Guillain-Barré syndrome. What I mean by that is in each community or in each area, you have certain positivity rates of these diseases. So at any one time, we'll see a certain number of Guillain-Barré syndrome or Bell's palsy cases in the hospital and in our clinics. And that number has not increased despite multiple, thousands of patients being vaccinated. Dr. Pate, can you Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, no, Dr. Williams, I totally agree. The Bell's palsy is fairly common, and we saw it long before COVID. And so you certainly are not surprised that some people get vaccinated and have Bell's palsy just as a coincidence. The other thing is, especially having those two family members, that's a little bit strange. What would cross my mind is that there are a lot of seasonal viruses that have been associated with Bell's palsy. And especially if they both got Bell's palsy during these fall and winter months, one would imagine they may have been infected by the same. These are very common viruses and they can result in Bell's palsy, but I think it's extremely unlikely that it's related to the vaccines. I think Dr. Williams is exactly right.
Mm-hmm. We have about 2 minutes left, and I just want to wrap once again, getting back to these mask guidelines. So Dr. Pate, bottom line, what is your best advice right now where we live when it comes to the CDC guidelines about taking your mask off indoors?
You know, my thought is that, you know, I appreciate aspects of the CDC advice. I'm not comfortable with it. If you are at increased risk, if you're much older, you know, an old person like me, if you have chronic underlying health problems, if you are immunocompromised, if you live with somebody that's like that, or if you have a small child in the home that cannot be vaccinated, while we are at these high levels, I would continue to wear a mask indoors. And at this point, and I've heard, you know, lots of people tell me that, hey, I'll just get infected because then I'll have super immunity. I think there's a lot of reason to question that strategy. I would be cautious about purposely or carelessly getting infected because, as Dr. Williams just talked about, and he just scratched the surface when he was talking about long COVID, there's so much more that we just don't have time to get to. But he laid out a lot of the key things. And let me tell you, and let me emphasize what he said, the people that get these symptoms, and we certainly could be talking on the order of 30 or more percent of people that get infected as adults, they're miserable. So I think I would continue to exercise caution until we know much more about the long-term effects of getting infected.
I want to thank both of you for your time today, for keeping us updated and answering questions. We've been talking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, along with Dr. Ryan Williams, the medical director for Direct COVID Care. It is a monoclonal antibody clinic in Boise. Dr. Williams is also a hospitalist at St. Alphonsus in Boise. If you have a COVID-19 question for our doctor roundtable, please send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu, because we will be back with our doctors next week. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Wednesday. Hope you have a good rest of your day. We'll see you back here tomorrow.